Welcome to Wine and Crime with Chris and Allie. This is Forensic Criminology Sister Style. I'm Chris.
Allie.
And we're here to bring you... Oh, that's what we do, yeah. that didn't go exactly as planned, but that's okay. This is our maiden voyage, as Allie likes to say. This is our first ever podcast. We've had this idea for a while now, and we've kind of talked it through and decided we were going to go for it. So we're hoping that on this podcast, we're going to bring you a little bit of a different perspective to true crime. I'll let Allie give you a little bit more of the details.
Okay, so we have a really strong interest in criminology, the criminal justice system, true crime, all of that, and it's super popular right in mainstream culture right now. And we love the true crime podcasts and books and shows and blogs, but my sister and I find ourselves talking about them, and we know a little bit of the words, you know, the jargon that we hear in those. But we figured, why not make a podcast and bring not only true crime out and give our opinions and our special takes on that, but also introduce some of these crime concepts or verbiage that you might hear as you're listening to these true crimes and kind of shed more light onto what that means. So that's what we hope to bring you guys.
So each episode we will introduce a different concept, and maybe it'll be something like a type of crime that, you know, we hear a lot about. And hopefully my sister and I can bring some of our experience and our education into this and shed some additional light on. And if not, we'll just have some cool conversation. If it's nothing new that you're getting, we at least will have a good discussion. And then Allie will bring, or I'll bring, an actual case that reflects those concepts or that has something to do with those concepts. And we'll dive into that a little bit. And then we'll talk about other implications that those types of concepts have in different, maybe a few different cases that are in the headlines or, you know, mainstream media. And then we'll give our take on it. And then we'll see you next week. That's kind of our idea. And here, I think, are we ready to get started?
Yeah, for sure.
So we are going to give you a little bit of background on our expertise, I guess, on our experience, on our education. As we kind of go on this adventure with you, we didn't want to make it too formalized and be like, this is who I am, this is who my sister is. I will just say, as just kind of an introduction, we are sisters. We're both criminologists. We both have degrees in criminology, and we've both been employed in the criminal justice system for a really long time, since like 2001, I think, for me, and maybe 2002 for Allie. So it's been a really long time. We've gotten old in crime. We literally, we were born into crime. My dad is a retired police officer, 35-year vet. Coming in, leave me alone, or set a, I'll do that next time. So he did different roles in the police department. I mean, he was a homicide detective. He was a DUI specialist. He was a school resource officer. He was a regular detective. I guess that's what it's called. I don't remember. And he was obviously a patrol officer, a sergeant, a corporal. He did a lot. And so he brought a lot of that home with him. So Allie and I became interested in crime and mayhem and nefarious pieces of shit really early on, and everything that I learned, my sister will talk a little bit about this, I in turn shared with her and made sure that she wasn't left behind. So if I learned something that I thought was crazy, I would share it with her, and we still do that today. Now we kind of share, now it's a mutual sharing, and she'll call me and share some fucked up shit with me, and I kind of like it that way. But for a long time I was just pouring all of this on my poor little sister as I started to become passionate about this world. And so we will get into more of that later, but I think right now we're just going to jump right in, and we're going to introduce this week's crime concept. And it's something that really makes my skin crawl. It's not my favorite thing, but it is something that I think is really important to know about and to talk about and to shed some light on. And so that's something that we're hoping to do today. Our concept is NHI. And if you've never heard of that, what that means is no humans involved. And it's really this whack ass way of dedicating resources. So officially, everything that I research and look at, it looks like it came out of Los Angeles during the crack epidemic, during a time where there was a lot of crime in poverty-stricken neighborhoods, and the disenfranchised were involved in a lot of different types of crime, whether it be drug overdoses, gang violence, prostitution, those types of crimes. And really, because the city was inundated with tons and tons of crime during this epidemic, resources were pretty scarce. And as a result, there became kind of this mentality of who deserves the resources. And if we call it an NHI case, that means that these people really don't deserve a lot of resources, whether it was an assault or a robbery, a burglary, or something like a body being found in an alley. A lot of times it would be categorized right up front as NHI, meaning we don't have to spend a lot of resources on this because these are people aren't important. They're crackheads or they're crack dealers or they're prostitutes. And so this even extends to murder victims. And then it started to kind of cross over into perpetrators and criminals. And it's an NHI crime. So we can just do whatever we want to this dude. And we're just going to solve the case. Whether or not he's guilty, we're going to make him look guilty. We'll talk about all of that. So there's lots of ramifications, both on the victim side of things and on the law enforcement. I'm sorry, the perpetrator side of things. And it was all based on this idea of who deserves the resources. And it's pretty fucked up. Allie, you want to add anything to that?
You did a really good job explaining it. But I just think NHI is prevalent in our society today. The mentality behind NHI begins and then it occurs at many different levels in our interaction with law enforcement, even today. So,
Absolutely.
traffic stops, community involvement, whether you're a victim reporting a crime or whether you're a suspect in a crime. Yeah, that's my little two cents.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So I'm going to kind of just give you a real life example of how I came to know this concept firsthand as a young person in this field. One of my first, actually my first, and this is pretty interesting, I think, my first job in the criminal justice system is right out of college. I came out of college fresh and gung-ho and ready to make a difference and change lives. And I was fortunate enough to be hired as the executive director of a nonprofit rape crisis center that was just getting off the ground. So that's kind of how I stumbled into it, because people with a lot of experience didn't want this type of program because it was just barely getting off the ground. So I had the opportunity to come in to obtain the 501c3, that's the nonprofit status, and to build a program. And so in researching what were the best sexual assault centers and rape crisis centers in the nation, what was going on that was making a difference, we discovered sexual assault response team and sexual assault nurse examiner programs. And they were existing in the hospitals, the nurse examiner programs, but it really wasn't a coordinated effort. And so that's really what the rape crisis center that I was hired to run took on. And so we developed a collaborative approach to sexual assault, meaning that when a victim reports a rape, a team collaborative and responds to that. So it's a team of somebody who's specially trained in law enforcement and sexual assault crimes, a nurse who can collect the physical and forensic evidence from the victim, and a crisis counselor. Somebody who can be a victim's advocate, come out and hold the victim's hand and help the victim to make it through the process, help to explain things, because a lot of times it's the system we found can really re-victimize victims. So they've been victims, they come in to make a report, and that can be re-traumatizing or re-victimizing for them. And so the whole goal here was to have a coordinated approach that was going to be beneficial to the victims and also lay out resources for the future. So crisis counseling, yes, but also support groups for rape victims, getting them hooked up with different resources that they may need, whether it be counseling or victims compensation, or somebody to go to court with them and somebody to be with them throughout the duration of this process, which is in some cases can take a long time. And so this is what the program that we developed really was. And when I started to recruit for victim advocates, crisis counselors, the first person I went to was my sister, of course. And she was just starting college at the time. And I told her, hey, I sold it to her as here's your opportunity to get some experience so that you're marketable when you get out. And we're going to do all these things. And she was kind of resistant at first. It was kind of like, I think I want to be a teacher. I don't think I want to go into this field because this is some crazy shit that I kind of want to get away from. And I don't know. And so lots of convincing. I brought her along with me, and she was my first crisis counselor, victim advocate. And I feel like that was the best choice ever. Allie, I don't know if that's true or not. I'll let you kind of speak to that. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I came along for the ride. I ch switched gears from education major to pre-law criminal justice, and you know, I never looked back and I don't regret it at all. So thank you, sister.
I think that you should tell this story too about your freshman orientation in college.
Yeah, so when we go to freshman orientation, and I had picked our university based on they had a really good one of the top education programs in the nation. And so I was all set up, right? Go to orientation and they say, okay, break up into your majors. And I look over and I see the education majors, you know, they're eager to learn and teach the youth of our society. And then I look over to the pre-law criminal justice, you know, social sciences sector, and I just felt a pull. And I said, nope, those are my people. And I went, you know, went
And
right
never
when
looked
I,
back.
yeah.
So yes, you're welcome for giving you the experience to get your foot in the door into a job. Awesome. I pass on the fortune and the blessings, actually, is what it is, as God has, I feel like, called us to be in this field and has put us in the right place at the right time, which is an amazing thing. And that is one thing about my sister and I, is we are very, very faithful Christians, and we believe in God's glory. And that is something that I think is impactful when you're working in this field, is to have that and to know that we're put in these places to do these things that are really hard. And we have to face some things that are really hard to face and deal with, which I'll talk about here with the NHI case. But it's because it feels like it's a calling, and it is definitely something that we're led to do. So enough about that. I'm going to jump into, so I'm running this rape crisis center. I'm about a year in. My pager goes off one night. I'm the one on call, and it's about 2:30 in the morning. It's a Friday night, snowing, it's cold out. I get called to the emergency room because there's a report of a sexual assault. And so on my way there, I got a call from the patrol officer who was responding as well. I'm going to call him Officer Smith because that's nice and anonymous. And so Smith calls and he's like, "Hey, did you get the call?" And I said, "Yeah, I did. I'm catching tonight. I'm on call." So 15 minutes out because of the storm, be careful, and I will see you there. And that just to me really was important because it was like, we are a team, we're coordinated in this, we're preparing together to go in and to help whoever it is that we need to help. And we're checking in with each other because it really was that team approach. So in that moment, I was so excited for our community, and all of the cool things that we were doing, to impact sexual assault and sexual violence. And so I show up at the hospital, and before I can get in to go talk to the victim, the nurse comes out, and Officer Smith was coming in around that same time. And she's like, "Before you go in, I need to let you know she's a hooker." And I kind of looked at her and I looked at Smith and I said, "Okay, can we get in and talk to her?" And she's like, "Yeah, but you need to know that she does this kind of thing. This isn't the first time that she's come in to the ER with some bullshit story. And she's a hooker." And so we're like, okay, both of us are kind of like, okay, well, that may be your experience, but we need to get in there. And she's saying she was sexually assaulted. Our team has been activated. No, I called you first, just the police department, which is who activated me. She said she called the police department because she's required legally to do that, but she wanted to make sure that it was a real rape. And I put that, I'm doing the air quote thing right now, a real rape before she got anybody out of bed. And I was like, okay, that's not how our protocol works. You call us all, you initiate us all at the same time so that we can be efficient and effective and not drag this on. Been through this ordeal. And she said, "Well, I just needed to make sure that it was a real rape. And so after you talk to her," she's telling the cop this, "after you talk to her, come back and let me know." And I at that moment said, "No, that's not how we're going to do this. I need you to activate the protocol in the way that it's designed. And if you go and read it, I will go show you where it is. And you will call the forensic nurse now, wake her up, because this woman has said she was sexually assaulted. And so you're not going to make that determination. We're not going to make that determination. We're going to go in and we're going to give her our services, because that's what we do." And so I was pretty irritated by that point. So needless to say, it was a shit show from there. We went in, and this woman was intoxicated. And she was pretty pissed off and pretty angry. And she was cussing at us and telling us we don't give a shit. And she doesn't know why. Apparently what happened eventually, as we built rapport with her and she started to tell us the story, she calmed down a little bit. But she said, you know, by her own admission, she was turning tricks that night. And this guy got kind of rough with her. So she was, you know, really, really upset. came back around the alley and hit her over the head, and she thinks it was the same man. She's not even sure, but she was pretty upset anyway. Hits her over the head, and then she wakes up and comes. She was unconscious for a bit, wakes up, and he's on top of her, and he's sexually assaulting her. So she said that, you know, she fought him off, but he had already sexually assaulted her. And she was screaming, and he took off running, and she flagged down a car, and this woman stopped to help her and dropped her off at the emergency room. And she's like, you know, I wouldn't have come here on my own. You know, the other chick that picked me up brought me here, so that's why I'm here. So we're trying to reassure her that we are taking this seriously, and that it's not okay what happened to her, and that we care, and that, you know, we're gonna go through our protocol, and we are gonna collect the evidence so that, you know, we can catch this person, or at least, you know, make those attempts. And so the sexual assault nurse examiner comes in, starts doing the rape kit, which and maybe the rape kit can be a concept in and of itself, because that is something that is really intense. The protocols that go along with that are pretty intense and can be so traumatizing to somebody who's just been through a horrible ordeal. So yeah, that's something to put on our list, Ellie, for later. So the rape kit commences, and in the meantime, Smith is calling the detective on call to explain what's happening. And normally what would happen is the detective would come out and take a statement and start to interview the victim, you know, to start to get the information as quickly as possible, or as, you know, efficiently as possible. So he comes and he tells me that because of who the victim is, the detective is not going to come out. And so, again, we have the first nurse who's like, you know, she's a hooker, so I don't even know why we're wasting our time. Now the detective is saying this, and this is a detective that, you know, I know and I work with, I worked with a lot, and I mean, he kind of had some attitude problems and some issues, but I was really disappointed. So I go back in after the rape kit's over, and I'm asking her who we can call for her, and she informs us that she lives with her pimp, and if he finds out that she was in the hospital and that she wasn't making money that night, he's going to beat the shit out of her. She has nowhere to go, no one to call, and she's terrified. So we make arrangements for her to go to the women's crisis shelter. We get her, you know, checked in there, settled there, and then I tell her, you know, I'll be back in the morning with the detective, because, you know, I'll be here to help you, to support you as he's interviewing you. And Officer Smith, at that time, I remember he leaned down, he kind of bent down because she was sitting down on a bench, and he kneeled, like squatted down, I guess, and grabbed her hand and gave her his card. And he said, I'm off duty for the next 2 days, but you can call me, my cell phone number's on there. If there's anything that I can do, anything that you need from me, anything that you remember that you just want to tell somebody, I'm here. Please, you know, call Christina, call me. We're here for you. And that just was so impactful for me, because this young cop and the young rape crisis counselor are all in, because this is what we chose to do, and we are so ready to make a difference in this world. And so that was just really meaningful. So at the same time, there's a lot of piece of shit cops. There's so many good ones also. So I just wanted to kind of give that some balance, because I'm about to tell you about a piece of shit detective. So give it a little bit of balance there. So the next day I show up to the crisis shelter, and she hadn't been contacted by the detective yet. So I call the investigations unit, and they tell me who's on the case. I'm going to call him Detective Bradley. Yeah, that's a good one. Detective Bradley. I have Detective Bradley's phone number, because he's kind of a ladies man, and he had made very, very sure that myself and my other attractive young crisis advocates and crisis counselors had his number in case we need help with the case, right? That's why he gave us his number. But I was going to use his number to help a victim at this point. So I call him, and I'm like, let's see what's going on here. And he's like, oh my gosh, Chris, how are you? How are things? And I said, you know, not, I was out last night on a case. And he's like, oh yeah, I heard. I said, and I'm here at the shelter with her, wondering when you're going to show up. When are you coming down to do the interview? And he said, oh, you know, that's like the last thing on my list. I don't know why you're, don't bother. You go back home. If you didn't get any sleep, you should be sleeping. It's no big deal. And I'm like, well, you know, it is a big deal, because she's here. She's sober now, and she's traumatized, and she has a lot to tell you. She's remembered a lot since last night. And he's like, well, I'm not going to give it very much credit anyway. You know who she is. And I said, I don't know who she is. I do now, because I met her last night. And, you know, I don't understand what you're saying. And he's like, so it's NHI. And I don't know if he said that or if I heard that. I know that's how he treated it, though. It's no big deal. It's an NHI. This is that concept, right? Of she doesn't matter. She's a prostitute. She's disenfranchised. She's just wasting our time and our resources. And in my head, I swear he said it. And I was, because I don't know where else I would have heard that con. It was really, really bad the way he was acting. So he went on to say how this was, you know, the last thing on his mind, and he was going to go have coffee with his friends and do these things, and I should meet them and have some coffee with them, and we talk about it further. And I had no intention of doing that. So I said, you know, that's not, to my understanding, that's not the way this works. And if I have to get, you know, other people involved, I will, which is really a shitty thing for me to have to say. My dad is a cop. This guy knows my dad. And I'm basically threatening to call the brass on him and say, you know, I have connections with people on my board of directors who are at the chief's level, at the deputy chief's level. I will reach out to them and let them know that, you know, this wonderful program we've designed really isn't working because some of the cops don't give a shit. And he said, well, you know, I understand that you're caring and you want to make a difference. And because you're Jay's daughter, and, you know, I know your dad, I'm going to go ahead and come out and do this investigation, start this investigation. It's not going to go anywhere, though, I'm telling you. But I'll do you a solid and come out and do my job is kind of what he gave me. So it was just, I mean, the whole situation was shitty. He came out, he treated her like shit. He talked to her like she was nothing. It never got prosecuted. I did make sure that it went up to the DA's office, and the DA was a little bit better. The deputy district attorney actually called me and said, let me explain to you why I'm going to no action or not take this case forward to prosecution. And he said, you know, we don't have the suspect. The DNA was kind of wonky. I mean, she had lots of DNA on her. It's just not a very strong thing for us to pursue and start investigating. And I don't think that even if we, you know, had the suspect, it would be a solid case. And so basically they kind of dropped it at that. I don't even know if they ever found a suspect or anything. So I continued to work with her. I'm going to call her Kelly. I continued to work with Kelly a little bit, and tried to get her into some services and some counseling. But during the time that I worked with her, she explained, you know, all that she had been through in her life and all of the trauma that she had endured, and essentially everybody harmed her that should have taken care of her and protected her. She never had that, and she was making the choice to be on the streets because she didn't think there was anything else that she could do. And so she did continue to be in the sex worker field and continue that life. And it breaks my heart because in those moments, I don't know if that could have impacted anything, but she was treated the way that she felt. And that's really hard. That's really hard. Coming from a victim services perspective, that's really hard when the system that is supposed to be there, again, somebody that's supposed to protect you and help you, just does more harm to you. And so I think that this NHI concept really does reflect that. And so that broke my heart and it stuck with me. And this was one of the things that my sister and I have talked about numerous times. I did go and try to do some investigating myself, and I talked to a lot of cops, including Jay, my daddy, and most of them got really squirrely, I'll just say that, when I mentioned the concept of NHI and said, you know, well, you know, it's not something that we say, but I mean, there was a time in the research that I did that over the radio, somebody would say, dispatch or the cop on duty would say, you know, it's an NHI. Like, don't worry about it. Take your time. Go have your coffee first. Like that kind of a mentality. And that's kind of the feel that I got in asking people about it. Of course, I have heard stories since then of things that have happened that let me know that this is very much a concept in law enforcement, and it's not just in the town that I live in. This is something that happens, and it's horrible, and that's why we wanted to shed some light on it. That's my 2 cents on the subject, Allie.
Okay. And I said my 2 cents earlier, right? Prevalent in our society, even today, even though like it's not maybe mainstream or on the radio or you know talked about in the light, but it really is prevalent in our society today. At least that mentality that leads into it, right? At the most basic level. So
All
yeah,
right,
that was a
let's
heavy one.
shift.
Can we delve into now our case of the topic of the week?
Yes, this is going to be interesting. Go for it.
All right. So every week we hope to bring you just like we did earlier, like to right now, the concept, the definition, some real world examples, and then we are going to delve into a case that displays that. And then we'll, you know, go more. All right. So our case today is the Grim Sleeper. I like to refer to him as Al A's notorious titty sucker, but he is not widely known by that moniker. That's just a me thing, in my research. But you might have heard of him from with the moniker the Grim Sleeper. Okay, so let's get into it. Lonnie Franklin was born August 30th, 1952, in South Central LA. He lived most of his life in South Central in LA. In his late teens, early 20s, he joined the army. He was stationed in Stuttgart, Germany. And while he was there, in his young 20s, he actually got discharged from the army, when he was convicted of gang raping a 17-year-old. So reportedly, Lonnie and his army buddies stopped and asked this teen for directions, and then they offered her a ride. When she accepted the ride and got into their car, they pulled a knife on her, put it to her throat, drove her out to a field, and repeatedly raped her. Apparently, this teen was of sound, mind and body. He was smart enough to fake some kind of interest in Lonnie and ask for his phone number. So when they were finished with their torture, right, and their rape, they dropped her off. They let her go, and she promptly took herself to a hospital where she filed a police report and turned over Lonnie's phone number. And so that's how they caught up with him, and he was convicted of that rape. I couldn't find much on what happened based on that conviction, but Lonnie, during that misadventure with the 17-year-old girl, had taken pictures of the whole ordeal. And so now, I thought that was a great idea, right? Take pictures of your misdoing.
Yeah.
So fast forward 10 years, 10-ish years, and Lonnie's back in LA. He's married with two children, and he has a penchant for picking up prostitutes and having them do some pretty kinky stuff. He began to not only utilize by paying for their services these prostitutes, but he began to also rape and murder them. Between the years of 1985 and 2010, Lonnie is credited with raping and murdering upwards of 100 victims. Some reports even more than that, and some reports a little less from what he has caught to. Lonnie's victims were African American prostitutes. So sadly, law enforcement, how they viewed them as NHI, they weren't looking into any of these cases with any kind of vigor. They, in fact, only caught Lonnie when his son was pulled over by accident in 2010. His son was pulled over for a DUI, so they kind of caught Lonnie by accident. And DNA was taken upon the son's arrest, and they found familial DNA matching one of the victims of the rapes and murders that were taking place in South Central. Turns out Lonnie's saliva had been found on a victim's chest because, as one of Lonnie's friends quoted, Lonnie was a titty sucker. So that's basically the story of Lonnie, right? And how he went on to victimize, rape, and murder upwards of 100 women and was not found and was, able to do it and get away with it for 30 years because of the victim status as NHI. So anything you want to add, sis?
Wow, yeah. So, in researching this, we watched both of us watched this documentary on, I think it was on Hulu, right? Called The Grim Sleeper, which was really difficult to watch, because it showed the disenfranchised. It showed that poverty and the addiction side of things, and what that looks like, and really how law enforcement did not respond, or did, what the response was. It blows my mind to think that I think they found in something that I read, he continued his picture taking and his photography with a lot of victims, and they found I think 180 images or pictures that he had taken of other women who had been missing. And when they started to piece that together in 2010, this had been going on since 1995. So for that period, he'd been doing this to women, and he could have been stopped if, like as you said, it's not like he was a smart criminal. He left DNA all over the place. He was
Sure.
he had pictures of victims when they really did make the connection with him.
it was like, duh, this is our suspect, or our this is the perpetrator in all of these offenses. And then they started, this reporter kind of came on board and started to tie it all together, and that's really what sealed it for him. And he finally did get prosecuted. I don't remember what for how many counts, but it was almost by accident. It was that he was caught. It wasn't with any intent. And that's really sad because a lot of lives were lost. There was also a movie, it was a Lifetime movie, and I think it was on Amazon Prime, I want to say, that I watched it, and it was also called The Grim Sleeper, and it was more of a produced, cleaned up, kind of prettier version of what actually happened in the case. And it's, involving actors and not real people, real life people. So I mean, either of those are really informative and kind of give you some insight into this case. This is one that I had never heard of until we started researching this. And again, we're true crime junkies. And so that was kind of shocking. I feel like we've been living in this case because we've been talking about it so much. But yeah, he was a, for sure, he was definitely the nefarious piece of shit that we talk about. He really was. And he was, yeah, I don't know, he might have been damaged himself. I don't really know.
Sure.
But that's Mr. Lonnie Franklin and the Grim Sleeper.
Right. Yeah. So I think the concept of NHI hits, comes full circle when Chris said this is a case we hadn't heard of until we started researching this. And I think that says a lot too, right? We hadn't heard of it, and an area in LA is missing 25 to 100 plus women, and they've gone, bodies have turned up and rapes and murders, and we didn't hear about it. That's kind of crazy, but that lends itself right to that whole concept of NHI.
Right.
These women didn't want.
And what do you
I'm
think?
thinking in our
Oh, there
neighborhood,
you go.
Chris,
That's where I
right?
was going to go. Yeah.
If a couple of women went missing, and were found raped and murdered, I would assume that law enforcement would attack those with great vigor and try to find out, and everybody would hear about this, right, nationwide.
Right,
That's
right.
just
And
me. Yeah.
that's what I was thinking. I was thinking that if somebody in my neighborhood didn't get back from the grocery store, within a couple
Yeah.
hours, we would probably have an APB out, and it'd be like a big deal, and
Sure.
search parties, and everybody would be looking, and it would definitely have been taken differently. And then to know that these bodies were discovered. I mean, they weren't, some of these bodies were discovered, and it was actually pretty up in our faces if anybody was looking. He wasn't, again, he
Right.
wasn't a stellar criminal. The system just
Not at
didn't
all.
give a shit.
DNA evidence everywhere.
That's the other piece that just really blows my mind. So, and I think that there are some other examples of NHI that we wanted to talk about in some popular cases, right?
Yep, sure. So the NHI hits, we've kind of touched on the victims of a crime. It could be the suspects of a crime. So in the case of the Central Park Five, which has become a pretty popular case as of late, the suspects in that case were seen as NHI.
Right.
And so I think when the suspects are viewed in that way, the law enforcement kind of attacks it with their agenda in mind and with great vigor to convict these people and
Close
kind
their
of make the
cases.
evidence fit their case. So that was with the case with the Central Park Five. And
Yeah,
there's a
that's also,
documentary on that one, right?
yeah, that's also a movie on, is that one on Netflix? When They See
I think
Us.
it
Yeah, that's When They See Us. They made that movie, which is really, really sad and really, really hard to watch, but it's so important as a concept because, yeah, absolutely.
Yep. So another one that was pretty popular and widespread was the Menendez brothers, the brothers who murdered their parents. Law
Interesting.
enforcement came out in reports and said that the victims of that case, the Menendez brothers' parents, were viewed as NHI. And this was kind of interesting to me because it had nothing to do with their social status, right? These people were people
Right.
of means, but they were viewed as NHI because of the terrible type of people that they were, right? They were terrible parents. They tor seemingly reportedly tortured their children and stuff. So I thought that was pretty interesting that these are,
Yeah.
people of means and can still be viewed that way.
Definitely, definitely. And I think that it goes without saying that kind of that my sister and I have a strong passion for disenfranchised and for people that society tends to throw away and forget. And it makes me really sad as a criminal justice professional that even today, I mean, even in today's day and age, and with all of the, all the progressive things that we've done in the field, there's still this mentality, and it still exists. I think that there was, we talked a little bit about racial stereotyping, racial profiling, and how that's tied to this. It really is like the ultimate form of stereotyping and profiling, which is really scary as minorities.
It
And I don't know if you wanted to kind of mention some of your fears and some of the things that this has impacted for you, this whole mentality and stereotyping, profiling.
And especially I didn't touch on it earlier, and like Chris said, we were going to kind of use up part of this episode to introduce personal level, but I think that'll just naturally and organically come out. But I am married to a man who is in the Air Force and who is African American. But throughout our years together of hit him in the service, for six, past 16 years, we've had the opportunity to live in many different states and many different countries. And so this is a concept, this racism thing, that I didn't even, for 8 years of my life, I lived in two different countries in Europe, and it didn't even play a part in that
Wow.
aspect in that time of my life. And not so much even when we were in the United States, when we were a young family and we had a young child. But now that we are back in the United States, it's something that I think of on a daily basis. You know, my son is a biracial little boy, but he looks African American. You look at him, oh, I'm getting choked up already. But you
Yeah.
look at him and you just see, you know, this little boy, he's African American, and
He's 16, by the
I
way.
worry about him. Right, he's 16. He's out driving around, so I worry him getting pulled over and profiled and mistreated. Him being somewhere with his friends that he has every right to be in and all the means to be there, but viewed maybe that he doesn't belong places. Or
Yeah.
we have to worry about how he dresses. We have to worry about the hairstyles he chooses. We had this discussion over this past weekend that his dad wanted him to let his hair grow out and get braids. And although I looked at him and I thought, oh my God, he'd look adorable with braids, my first thought was, oh, how would he be viewed by society? And that's terrible. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it really is, and but it's reality. And I think and just a little bit about my nephew. He's articulate and he's brilliant and he gets amazing grades and he's a little athlete and he is wise beyond his years and compassionate, caring, everything you'd want in a boy. And to think about it in that way, that there's something that some things that are taken away from him just because of the color of his skin, it freaking infuriates me. And it breaks my heart.
And the area that we chose to live in is a little bit, it's a little suburban, right? It's a little bit removed, but we are very near a big city.
Right.
And so when he goes downtown to the bigger city with his friends and he's wearing his hoodies and his stuff, my
Oh my,
anxiety is
yeah.
through the roof. That's ridiculous.
Yeah,
Such a ridiculous thing to have to worry about in the year 2019 that we're in.
Well, and that's something that I did want to touch on again, another movie. We're both movie buffs. I mean, we read, read, read. We delve into all of the scientific literature and in all of that in our criminology field. And then we also watch a shit ton of movies that we're always comparing. And then we're comparing, is that legit? Do you think that was real? What parts do you think they got wrong? And it's an amazing thing that I do. But another movie called The American Son, and that was on Netflix. And Olivia Pope, what is her name? Her real name.
I can't
She's
think of her
the
name.
one that plays the woman that plays Olivia Pope is the mother in there. And it's about a biracial couple who have a son who goes missing. And it's just mind-boggling. And I was in tears because of my nephew. I was thinking that he for a long time was into, well, he still is into hoodies. And my mom and I were constantly sending him hoodies, different types of fun hoodies that we found around so he could wear. And then I had this realization that I'm not buying him any more hoodies with the whole Trayvon Martin situation. Like, I'm sorry, dude, I can't buy you hoodies. And it's because you're black and I don't want you running around in a hoodie because it scares me. And that is heartbreaking. But this movie really did capitalize and capture that how that and in this movie it was really interesting because the dad was white and the dad was an FBI agent. And just kind of seeing all of these things play out was just it was just it was infuriating and heartbreaking. And it's just really scary. And I guess that's the takeaway message is that we all have a responsibility if we want things to change to make those changes in our circles, right? and to have these
absolutely
conversations with our friends. And there's so much hype right now, you know, the Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter, and so much, so much of that controversy around it. And really what it comes down to is people and being human and being good people. And if we can all make that as a goal, I think we could have lots and lots of success.
Right, absolutely. So you touched on the Black Lives Matter thing. And while I think those movements are very positively based and meant to be motivational and bring about change, I do think that that sometimes backfires in our society as it is.
Yeah.
And it creates more tension, more and racial division, tension.
For sure.
In more division, for sure. So I think it's that old adage, if you want to make a change in the world, you start within your home. You go home and you love your family. And my sister and I have done that in spades, but we have also taken it out into our communities, and we try to help and try to be victims advocates anytime and any place that we can.
Absolutely.
In our professional and our personal life.
And I can also just kind of hang on to that, what you said. It's really heartbreaking because right now my current career is in the corrections field, the correctional prison type, and I do a lot of training with lots of different law enforcement, but a lot of correctional officers. And there's, you know, so many things that are just wrong with society. And I see it. And I see people who are in this progressive culture and this amazing environment where we have, you know, some progressive thinking going on, and people are fighting it, and people do want to keep these types of stereotypes and profiling and things alive. And so there are some people dedicated to doing that. And so I make it my mission to be dedicated to doing what I can to heal some of that. Take a deep breath.
I mean, we can go on forever, right? But we do have to come to a close. But yeah, we can talk about this kind of stuff forever. And we in fact do all the time. This is where this whole podcast idea came about, because we talk hours and hours weekly about all this stuff.
Yeah. And so it's kind of neat. And if you're listening, obviously you pressed like, because something in our title interested you, it might be the wine. And we do, you know, partake of a little bit of wine as we're doing this, just to kind of, because that's what we like to do, is drink wine and talk to each other. So we brought that element with us.
Right. So if you like wine, or if you like crime, or the combination thereof, then this is your place. And we hope that you come back with us week after week, because we have a whole list going already of awesome ideas and awesome crime concepts that we want to bring to life for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess we're signing off for now. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. If you're listening to this, we don't know the whole podcast game. We're going to figure it all out, though. But thank you for being on this journey with us. Again,
absolutely.
Thanks for listening to Wine and Crime with Chris and Allie. Bye.
We study crime. That's what we do.
Yeah.
Bye, guys.
Bye.